Was University Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. A major earthquake struck northeast Japan Tuesday, close to the massive 9.0 magnitude quake that killed more than 18,000 in March 2011 and caused a coastal nuclear power plant meltdown. Tuesday's quake, measured by U.S. seismologists at 6.9 and in Japan at 7.4, struck off the coast of Fukushima Prefecture. U.S. geophysicist Rafael Abreu of the U.S. Geological Survey said a 1.4-meter tsunami washed ashore.
Any type of movement that disturbs the water column, if you do any movement on the ocean floor, whether you raise it or if it goes down, which is likely to what happened in this case, that type of disturbance is going to create a disturbance in the water column, and that is what creates the tsunami.
The quake struck about 11 kilometers underground, some 250 kilometers northeast of Tokyo, where Temple University Asian professor Jeff Kingston felt it.
We're used to getting lots of earthquakes. Japan gets more above 6-magnitude earthquakes than probably any other country in the world. But yeah, this was quite a good rattle.
There were no immediate reports of casualties or damage. A pump that supplies cooling water to a spent fuel pool at the Fukushima Daini nuclear plant stopped working, but a backup pump took over. In Libya, a car bomb blast outside a hospital in Benghazi Monday killed 3 children and wounded more than 24 other people. Some critically, the streets were full of children who had finished school for the day. No immediate claim of responsibility. Benghazi has been the scene of more than 2 years of fighting between forces loyal to renegade military commander Khalifa Haftar and Islamic militants. Meanwhile, forces loyal to Libya's national unity government reportedly are closing in on the last Islamic State fighters in Sirte. This is VOA News. A top U.N. official told the Security Council Monday the number of Syrians besieged in their country's conflict has doubled in the past year to nearly 1 million. UNA Chief Stephen O'Brien saying the number of held captive by government forces reached 850,000. Many others are at the mercy of Islamic State and other armed groups. He urged the council into action.
I hear the argument that this council should not pass a resolution because it would be, quote, premature. Mr. President, it is never, never too premature to save a life. It is never too soon for you to find a solution to this conflict and end the suffering of the Syrian people.
Meanwhile, U.S. UN Ambassador Samantha Power named a dozen Syrian generals and other officers, accusing them of leading attacks on civilian targets and running torture prisons.
Today, I would like to specify some of the names of those involved since 2011 in killing and injuring civilians by conducting air and ground-based Syrian government military assaults on cities, residential areas, and civilian infrastructure. The United States will not let those who have commanded units involved in these actions hide anonymously behind the facade of the Assad regime.
Meanwhile, in Aleppo, Russian-backed government forces claim to have taken control of a neighborhood in the rebel-held eastern sector. President-elect Donald Trump has met with a number of new people he's considering for top posts in his administration when he's sworn in January 20th. He also outlined his plans for his early days in office in a video released Monday to the American people, including withdrawing from the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement.
I am going to issue a notification of intent to withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a potential disaster for our country. Instead, we will negotiate fair bilateral trade deals that bring jobs and industry back onto American shores.
Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe said the TPP would be rendered meaningless without U.S. participation. Russia has deployed sophisticated anti-ship missiles in the nation's westernmost region, Kaliningrad, bordering the territory of NATO members Poland and Lithuania. U.S. spokesman John Kirby called the move destabilizing.
So while we understand that Russia has the right to exercise its conventional nuclear forces on its own territory, the deployment of Iskander and S-400 missiles to Kaliningrad is destabilizing to European security. Russia has made threats to move Iskander missiles to Kaliningrad now for the past decade in response to a variety of developments in Europe, none of which demand such a military response.
He called on Moscow to refrain from words or deeds that are inconsistent with the goal of promoting security and stability. For the first time since the Second World War, Japanese troops under orders to use force if necessary have been deployed overseas. Some 350 arrived in South Sudan to join other UN peacekeepers. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bote in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 22nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Malawi's president said his government has found a better handle on the food shortages facing the country.
We have bought enough maize and other foodstuffs to be given for free, the price, and most vulnerable people who cannot afford to buy food.
That's Malawi President Peter Mutharika speaking Monday night in a nationwide speech. Sierra Leone authorities released on bail a student charged with using social media to incite violence. Jogging in Burundi is not just an exercise, but a means to bring about healing. And where's former South Sudan first Vice President Riek Machar?
We had the same information as you heard it, that the former first vice president, the rebel leader, Riek Machar, has been deported from Ethiopia to South Africa.
Ateng Wekateng is spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. Meanwhile, a rebel spokesman said Riek Machar simply passed through Ethiopia in transit. And the Vatican and the UN have joined forces to condemn human rights abuses in the fishing industry. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Malawi President Peter Mutharika says his country has now acquired enough food to feed nearly half of the country's population in need of food assistance. President Mutharika spoke Monday night in a national address to Malawians. Lamek Masina reports for VOA from Blantyre.
This is his second address to the nation this year since May. Many Malawians had asked the president, mostly through social media, to address the challenges facing the country. Malawi is facing many challenges, including drug shortages in public hospitals, corruption, and food insecurity. Its economy declined from 6.2% in 2014 to 3.2% in 2015. Recent statistics show it will decline further to 2.8% in 2016. Speaking on the state-run media, Mutharika says Malawians should not panic because all the measures are in place to address the challenges.
I know the pain most of us have been feeling. I also understand that our impatience to urgent get out of our challenges because the nation has suffered in poverty for many years. Ladies and gentlemen, the challenges we face are not insurmountable. Together, with a unit of purpose, we can overcome them.
Malawi is currently experiencing its worst food insecurity problem in a decade. Experts say this is largely because of El Nino weather phenomenon, which caused drought and floods that affected the crops over the past 2 years. A recent report from the Malawi Vulnerability Assessment Committee showed that 6.7 million Malawians are in dire need of food assistance. This is nearly half of Malawi's population. Mutharika said no Malawian will die of hunger.
We have bought enough maize and other foodstuffs to be given for free to the price and most vulnerable people who cannot afford to buy food.
He said the government and its development partners have developed a near $400 million food insecurity plan to guide the response program from 2016 to 2017.
The response is two modalities, in-kind food transfer, targeting 4,751,862 people, and cash transfers targeting 1,734,806 people.
Mutharika said his government is working with development partners to address the drug shortage problems and end corruption in the country. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
A spokesman for South Sudan, former first vice president and rebel leader Riek Machar, is denying that Mr. Machar was deported by Ethiopian authorities as he arrived in the country from South Africa. A report citing anonymous Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition sources said Mr. Machar was trying to enter his rebel headquarters in Pagak, South Sudan, near the Ethiopian border, but was told by Ethiopian authorities to return to South Africa. SPLMIO representative Minyong Kwan says Dr. Machar was in transit in Ethiopia and was never told by Ethiopian authorities to leave the country.
That is not true. James, my chairman, Dr. Riek Machar, had a visit to another country. He went to Ethiopia as a transit. He went and did his visit and came back to Ethiopia for another transit back to South Africa. The government has no knowledge of what we do because it is our affairs. What Dr. Emachar is doing is not their job. So they cannot tell you something that is not true. It's another propaganda that they are very famous about.
How true is the story? Was Dr. Machar in Ethiopia? And was he told by the authorities in Ethiopia that he had to leave Ethiopia?
I have just told you, James, he went to a visit to another country, went to Ethiopia for a transit. And you know what the transit means? He has not been told by any authority to leave Ethiopia. When you are there for a transit, you're actually going to leave in a certain matter of hours. So nobody told him to leave. And whatever the Juba authority or government is saying is another propaganda. Is that nothing happened like that.
So one account said that, and I was talking to the presidential spokesman, Atain, saying that perhaps the Riek Machar was trying to use Ethiopia to sneak back into Pagag to cause more havoc.
Riek Machar is the chairman and commander-in-chief of the SPLA-IO. He is in charge of IO areas and IO armies and the leaders, wherever they are. He has the right to go wherever he wants, and whatever they are saying, calling it sneaks to South Sudan, that is not true.
Do you think, with Ethiopia, if this is true now, that the Ethiopian government told him that either he had to return, as you said, he was in transit. But do you think now Africa or some African countries might be kind of fed up with what is going on in South Sudan and do not want to entertain anything like having your leader in their country?
Yes, they are very fed up of what Salva Kiir is doing, killing innocent people in the country. Yes, I can understand that the leader of Africa are very fed up. And it's their job and his responsibility to correct what Salva Kiir is doing.
So where is Dr. Machar now?
Dr. Machar is in safe place, is in where he was before, is in South Africa, and is fine, nothing wrong.
You know that the Security Council is kind of considering a draft resolution to impose arms embargo, and there are some who are blaming him for his announcement that to want to start a rebel movement.
James, what had happened in South Sudan, the war was declared by Salva Kiir Mayardit. He declared that in 2013. He declared the war again in July 8, 2016. What is happening now is that the innocent people that are being killed by Salva Kiir are just fighting back to what is happening. So we are resisting a government and a president that is targeting people that are citizens of the country.
Myung Kwon is the SPLM-E opposition representative. He was speaking with me from Washington. A spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir says his government has heard that Ethiopian authorities deported former first vice president and rebel leader Riek Machar. Atain Wek Atain denies that his government has told Ethiopian authorities to deny entry to Mr. Machar, but he said the Ethiopian government realizes that the former rebel leader was trying to use Ethiopia to enter his rebel headquarters in Pagak, South Sudan, from where he was going to wage war on the country.
We had the same information as you heard it, that the former first vice president, the rebel leader, Riek Machar, has been deported from Ethiopia to South Africa as he was trying to get to his headquarters in Pagak from Ethiopia, but Ethiopia denied him access to that place. That's what we know about.
Has your government been telling, say, countries like Ethiopia not to allow access to Riek Machar in case he wants to come back into their country?
No, we are not telling countries. We don't have any power to tell other countries not to do so, but those countries have realized the fact that Riek is coming back only to cause havoc. The SPLM-IO leadership has already moved on. They have appointed a new leader, and that new leader is actually implementing peace agreement. So for the interest of the people of South Sudan, those countries decide to stand with the people of South Sudan instead of with the one person called Riek Machar. So it is the interest of the people of South Sudan that has prevailed.
Are you saying that Dr. Machar was trying to enter or were going to Ethiopia in order to go to South Sudan?
That's what he's actually looking for, exactly. He went to Ethiopia, in order to gain access to South Sudan, that part of South Sudan. The interest of the people of South Sudan is strong. the relationship between Ethiopia and South Sudan is cordial, and it has moved on beyond the interest of one individual. So the interest of the people of South Sudan has been properly addressed by Ethiopian.
Your president has said, President Salva Kiir has said, that he was being approached by certain people, at least from Machar, asking that he should pardon Dr. Machar. Is that true?
First of all, there's nobody that has actually spoke to President Salva Kiir about Machar. The position of President Salva Kiir in regards to Machar is very clear. If Machar denounced violence and returned to South Sudan as citizen of South Sudan, the president will pardon him if he renounced violence. But if he insists on violence, then there's no way for him to be pardoned.
I spoke to an SPLMIO official who told me that right now the violence in Wau and the other state, that is the work of the government people. So it's not Riek Machar people who are doing the violence.
Well, it defeats the logic. The government doesn't attack its own people. Rather, it is the work of criminals. Those who wanted to see the government, being seen as culprit, are the ones who are causing havoc so that they drive wedge between the people of South Sudan, the better citizen, and the government of South Sudan. The violence that is happening in the whole country is masterminded by Riek Machar.
Aten Wek Aten is spokesman for South Sudan President Salva Kiir. He was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 22nd. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Listen, shout out to listeners on our affiliate station, Yambio FM in Yambio, South Sudan, Voice of the People Radio in Juba, South Sudan, Liberty FM in Ye, South Sudan, and Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi. Daybreak Africa time is now 17 minutes past the hour. In Burundi, jogging has gone beyond just an exercise to stay fit and fight obesity to a way of bringing about national unity and peace building in a country that has been rocked by political crisis for more than a year. Moses Havyarimana reports from Bujumbura.
After a few kilometers of jogging each day, some Burundians gather near Lake Tanganyika, a favorite meeting point to do physicals like stretching, usually with an instructor. Burundians have formed jogging clubs and associations that have turned the activity into more than just a sporting event. Ibrahim Hussein is the instructor of one of the jogging clubs. He says that sports helps the body to stay fit because even doctors tell them when you don't do sports, a person can be exposed to some diseases. And that's why they are here. Hussein says it is now more than 7 years since he last suffered from any kind of disease. In addition to keeping people healthy and fit, jogging also brings them together as a community. Jogging, walking, and playing football or basketball are the common activities in Burundi, which most people engage in 4 days a week, especially Fridays and Sundays. Many Burundians have been inspired by this culture of jogging, with almost 50% of the population jogging at least once a week. Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza himself leaves office on Tuesday and Friday afternoons to go and play football. It is compulsory in some government institutions to jog every Friday afternoon. You could be penalized if you fail to show up. Nizigimana Marie Rosette is the permanent secretary of the Ministry of Public Works in Burundi. She says jogging also provides an opportunity for both employers and employees to discuss work or societal issues.
Sometimes you don't have, they can't reach to the Bureau of the Ministers, but in the sport, we are together. They can talk something which is going good or bad. So they talk and we share easily in a good weather. When we evaluate, we saw that it helped to bring a good environment in the work.
The permanent secretary says while some workers may miss out on some days, Friday afternoon is taken seriously by all. According to the permanent secretary, jogging is regarded not just as a sporting activity to keep people fit, but also it is a way to bring Burundians together regardless their ethnicity. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
A court in Sierra Leone on Monday released on bail student Teresa Mbomaya, who had been arrested and charged with incitement for allegedly sharing information on social media about the government's decision to withdraw subsidies on petroleum products, thereby increasing the pump price of fuel. Mbomaya had also been charged with threatening public safety. Emmanuel Safa Abdullah is a lawyer and one of the leaders of the Sierra Leone Renaissance Movement, which is pressuring the government to end the fuel price hike. He says a large crowd turned out on Monday to give moral support to Ms. Mbomaya.
Clearly, we went back to court because Monday was the adjourned date and went to provide the representation for Teresa. Interestingly, she was brought to court, but before that, we realized that the entire courtroom was jam-packed with people who were showing solidarity. But interestingly also, we had lawyers who have been known for supporting the ruling government. We have lawyers who have been known for sitting on the sideline when issues of this moral privity are coming up in the country. So it was kind of a surprise to see everybody showing up with a concern that fundamental human rights of a poor girl has been suppressed and this will have wider implications.
Were there other students besides lawyers? Did you have other people supporting the girl?
Yes, there were a lot of people. I mean, in fact, it's a very large courtroom. The courtroom number one in the Freetown High Court is a very large courtroom. It was jam-packed with people from different walks of life and students. And then the proceedings started and the magistrate granted the bail that she could be set on bail for 50 million liens, which is about $7,000, and with two sureties in like sum to ensure that she appears before the court for the next hearing. Outside of the court, there were over 300 students who spontaneously came to that venue with their placards. Now, basically just standing there and with their placards without saying anything. These placards had various inscriptions like, it is fair price, free Teresa, freedom of expression, it's a right, you know, you can't suppress our freedom. And they stood around the court building. Now, there was no chaos. There was no confrontation. Now, the implication of this is basically that the Sierra Leone police should learn that people are willing to peacefully demonstrate in a city like Freetown. These were students. Students could be tempted to go rough sometimes when they are on the street, but they were able to comport themselves and people went about their businesses. People took photos of what they were doing and they went right to the conference room where they had a press release. Now, the police should stop using the excuse of public order, public disorder or chaos in depriving constitutional rights of people to protest and to express themselves.
So, Emmanuel, when's the next court date for Ms. Mbomaya?
The next court date is Monday. We are still hoping that next Monday, we're still hoping that the authorities will, when I say next Monday, I mean the 28th of November, we're still hoping that the authorities will review this file and have a common sense that, you know, the laws of suppressing free expression, laws of incitement, are no longer necessary in a democratic society. They are outdated and they are obnoxious, and we need to move forward with moving our democracy, and our people need the freedom to express themselves against anything that they feel strongly against.
Emmanuel Safa Abdullah is a lawyer and one of the leaders of the Sierra Leone Renaissance Movement. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. The Vatican and the UN have joined forces to condemn human rights abuses in the fishing industry, including forced labor, child labor, human trafficking, and slavery. They held a joint news conference yesterday, Monday, World Fisheries Day. VOA's Jody Kapua reports.
UN Food and Agriculture Organization Director General José Graziano da Silva says, sadly, the same industry that offers so many opportunities also victimizes the most vulnerable. He says abuses occur in both developed and developing countries. Every year, about 24,000 fishermen and women lose their lives. Graziano da Silva says the problem is also linked to the surge in migration.
The stress of migration have been seen in recent years has strong links to forced labor and poor working conditions, in addition to weakening coastal fisheries communities. For this reason, FAO is developing the Blue Hope Initiative in the Mediterranean region in order to stress livelihoods in coastal communities.
The FAO and the Vatican say the abuses often occur in illegal operations that haul up to 26 million tons of fish from the oceans each year. The FAO chief says rights must extend to all those in the fishing industry.
We have to guarantee that the sea food reaching our plates has been produced not only in an environmentally sustainable manner, but also in a manner that supports the socioeconomic well-being of those who harvest and process it. FAO looks forward to make this a reality, and we are very pleased to work with the Holy See on this initiative.
Vatican Secretary of State Cardinal Pietro Parolin says for the fishing industry to have sustainable long-term prosperity, it must guarantee a level of human well-being that is compatible with environmental protection.
2 centuries after the abolition of the transatlantic slave trade, at least 20.9 million people continue to work under coercion, largely in the informal and illegal economy. About 90% of today's forced labor is imposed by private agents, primarily in labor-intensive industries such as fisheries.
The Vatican official says many forced to work in the fishing industry lack even the basic human rights.
It means living in degrading conditions and in confined spaces, in circumstances that are tantamount to detention, with their documents confiscated and, in only a few cases, returned after long periods of forced and underpaid labor.
To help end the problem, consumers are being called on to buy only fairly and sustainably produced fish. Also, the International Labor Organization's Convention 188 is set to take effect 1 year from now. The convention is designed to ensure that workers in the fishing sector benefit from safety and health care, written work assignments, and Social Security protections. Supporters say Convention 188 will boost the effectiveness of an earlier treaty targeting illegal and under- and unreported fishing through port inspections of fishing vessels. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of news. An attempt to block creation of an independent expert to challenge violence and discrimination directed at homosexuals and other persons based on gender identity failed Monday in the UN General Assembly Human Rights Committee. African states led by Botswana retroactively sought to block the work of V.T. Muntabaum, whose mandate came into effect on November 1st as the first UN independent expert on the protection against violence and discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. The position was created by the Geneva-based UN Human Rights Council last June. That's it for this Tuesday, November 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good day.
Hello, Africa. This is Peter Clotty, host of VOA's Africa Weekend show, Nightline Africa. Tune in. You will be glad you did.
Nightline Africa is a fast-paced, tightly edited news show designed to keep our listeners engaged from beginning to end. Nightline comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies: 6080 kHz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kHz, 19.2 meter band.
Hello, Africa music fans. We have hours of the music that you love every day. From the north to the south and the east to the west, we play only the best. Tune in at 0100, 0200, 1200 and 1300 UTC, GMT, right here on VOA Africa.